Justin, before you start, we're going to have to finish our conversation we had. I came to work today, and my LA said that she enjoyed listening to the radio today because Dr. Stenson was laughing. Said, I didn't think that was capable. And I said, well, I heard him too, and it was someone asked, the reporter asked if he had coffee regularly with the governor, and Dr. Stenson asked it by saying, I don't drink coffee, and chuckled. So welcome, Dr. Stenson.
Go ahead and just jump to number five.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we're going to talk off of this handout that the members
should
have.
You need to pull the mic a little bit closer.
Yeah. We're gonna talk off of the handout that the members have. The first two pages really tell you what you already know, which is we have a $994 million shortfall. The top of the third page just describes in a little bit more detail where the revenue shortfall came from. And as in November, it's almost all in the individual income tax. The official numbers are that it's $874 million short, but as you know, there was a recharacterization of some revenue that was other revenue into income tax because of the elimination of the reciprocity. Before, reciprocity was carried in a separate item in the other revenues. Now it's withholding is carried forward just as part of revenue.
So, Dr. Stenson, explain that just a little bit more. If we had continued with reciprocity, would we be up or down from the from our budget standpoint?
We would be down just slightly, but if we'd have continued with reciprocity, the all other in the top of page three, the chart in the top of page three, would be more than $100 million smaller, and the income tax line would be more than $100 million larger. And so the point is that out of the $1.1 billion, about $1 billion of the shortfall is individual income tax.
Okay.
The changes are small. You know, we can go into them in more detail if you want to, but really there weren't large changes in the revenues, and the reason why there weren't large changes in the revenues was that there wasn't much in the way of a change in the economic forecast. Normally I would show you a graph on the bottom of page three that shows the difference between the November forecast and the February forecast. This time, because there really wasn't very much difference, what I'm showing you is the alternatives that Global Insight has provided. And those alternatives are three. One is a weaker than baseline scenario called a W or a double dip recession. That's the small dotted line in that chart. That one you can see. Revenues are the economy doesn't get back to the level that we were at in 2008 until almost 2012. It has a 15% probability. The heavy black line is the line that shows the path that Global Insight ascribes the highest probability to. That's the baseline scenario. It's a 65% probability. The common way that analysts and forecasters are describing this is a U-shaped recovery. And then they show a more optimistic scenario that they have a 25% probability assigned to, which is the V or the more robust economic growth scenario that sometimes you hear people hoping for.
Can I just go back a little bit to the just for people's understanding of the all other, when you have a dip of $78 million in all other, my understanding is that the tobacco is down $26 million and fines and surcharges are down about $30 million. on that. Maybe either yourself or the commissioner or Mr. Showalter can kind of explain what's happening in those two categories. It is significant in that all other are things like deed tax, and I believe some MVET is in there that maybe is there. I don't know if there's any left in that or not.
About the fines.
But maybe you can just explain at least those couple of items that seem to be big drops in revenue.
Right. I'll let Mr. Showalter explain a couple of those things.
Okay. Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director. The couple of items you mentioned include the change in tobacco settlement payments. There was a significant increase in the federal tax on tobacco products. I got it in my notes somewhere here. And it was like 61 cents, I believe. What happened was we reduced the anticipated demand due to some elasticity. The actual elasticity of demand due to the increased cost was greater than anticipated. That drives down number of sales. That drives down payments to states, including ours. That is reflected in this February forecast. On the surcharges and other fines revenue, I will get back to you with some more information. As I understand it, much of it is tied to the public safety revenue increases that were adopted in the 2009 legislative session, and that those are not coming in at this point as anticipated, and I'll get you some more information on that.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, one other thing about the tobacco settlement. Part of that reflects just the lower base that we're starting from. We actually received less in our end-of-year payment than we expected in November, and so part of it's just recognition of the fact that we received less. The other things that in the other revenues that were down, tobacco revenues in general, the tobacco tax revenues in general were down by about $10 million. The insurance gross premiums tax was also down by about $10 million. The $10 million decline in tobacco tax receipts probably, again, was due to the higher taxes and then reduced consumption. Returning back to the bottom of page 3, this V-shaped recovery, the more optimistic recovery, has a lot stronger economic growth in it than the baseline U-shaped recovery. The growth rates 4.2 and 4.3 versus 3% and 2.8%, and that certainly accelerates output in the economy, accelerates the activity in the economy. But if you turn to the top of page 4 and examine the graph at page 4, what you see is that it doesn't make a lot of difference in the recovery for employment, which is what we're concerned about. Even under the more optimistic scenario, it takes until midway through 2012 for employment in the U.S. to get back to the level that it was in 2007. And of course, in that period, that 5-year period, there have been more people entering the workforce, and so the unemployment rate will be much higher than it will be than it was in 2007. The graph on the bottom of page 4 shows first, the colored area shows the employment under the baseline scenario, and you can see under the baseline scenario, employment doesn't get back to the level of 2007 until early 2013. But it also, the lighter colored bars show the unemployment rate, and you can see that the unemployment rate still remains above 8%. This forecast in Minnesota, we think we're, in terms of employment, we think we're very close to a turning point, if not at a turning point, for employment. Yesterday's jobs numbers for Minnesota for January were certainly very good news, 15,000 plus jobs added in January. But we don't expect that we're going to have really strong growth looking on out into the future, that the 15,000 jobs is an aberration, that you know, we think we'll average something more on the order of 2,400 or so a month.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, with regard to the projected increases in employment, could you address what some of the underlying assumptions are that would cause those increases in employment? I mean, specifically, are we talking about people going back to work doing what they were doing, or are people finding something different to do?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilge, that's certainly a concern, and it's a both a short-term concern and a longer-term concern for the state and for employment. We've lost 160,000 jobs in the last 2 years. Of those 160,000 jobs, about 110,000 of them have come in manufacturing, construction, and retail trade. About half of the job losses in manufacturing, and then a quarter each in construction and retail trade. We expect in the next 2 years to have only about 40,000 jobs, or about a third of those jobs, recover. About half of the manufacturing jobs, 10,000 of the 26,000 jobs lost in construction in there. So that means that people that are unemployed in those sectors are going to have to be concerned about whether they will be able to find, or, well, it's going to be difficult for those people to find jobs in that sector. Now, some of it will occur because there will be people that will retire, and so you'll have replacement of jobs in that sector, but there's certainly going to be a skills mismatch that people are going to have to be conscious of. And the challenge for moving the Minnesota economy on ahead 4 years from now, 5 years from now, 6 years from now, is how quickly we can adjust the skill set of the people that are out there looking for work to match the skills needed in the new positions that they have, which are not necessarily going to be similar to the positions that they used to hold. And that's going to be a real challenge.
Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Bill, Representative Hill, were you finished?
For now, yes. Thank you.
Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Dr. Stinson, the ADP employment number earlier this week came out nationwide as minus 20,000, yet in Minnesota we see a plus 15,000 figure. I'm wondering if you could, if there's any policies we're doing here in Minnesota that seem to be working better to account for the seemingly more positive number in Minnesota versus the nationwide numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Groffel, the ADP number is a February number. It's a precursor to Friday's number for February for U.S. employment overall. The 15,600 number was a January number for Minnesota. Now, that said, it's still negative and positive, and so I think what we have seen over the last 6 to 9 months is it appears that Minnesota has turned around a little quicker than the U.S. average has. Part of that may be that we went into this recession a little sooner. We still have a larger loss in employment between 2001 and now, the start of the 2001 recession and now, than the U.S. average over that period. But in the last 6 months, we've done better than the U.S. On some basis, say, if you look at the start of this recession. So it may just be that we're turning around a little more quickly than the U.S. average. You can imagine that California, as big as California is and as difficult as economic times are in California, if California is significantly underperforming the U.S. average, then almost everybody else would be outperforming the U.S. average just because of the the size of the numbers in California. But still, our unemployment rate is noticeably lower than the U.S. average, and that's good. And we have been adding jobs, and the U.S. economy hasn't. Over the next few months, we're going to see U.S. job growth because of the census. It's not going to be disproportionate to Minnesota. In fact, Minnesota probably is not going to receive quite as many jobs as our population share would indicate for the temporary census jobs. And so we may lag the U.S. a little bit over the next 6 months or something like that. But, you know, again, our belief is that it's very likely that we have turned the corner in terms of job growth. February's numbers may be a little bit weaker, but we think March's numbers will be back up in April and then going from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Stinson. The unemployment numbers that they've been going around, touted around here, do they take into effect the people that are long-term unemployed, that are out of unemployment, or does this just count the people that are currently collecting unemployment?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the unemployment numbers come not from a count of people that are receiving unemployment insurance, but rather from a survey. And in that survey, there are a series of questions asked. One is, are you working? If you answer yes, you're obviously not unemployed. Two is, if you're not working, did you look for work in the last month? If you looked for work in the last month and you're not working, then you're counted as part of the labor force. If you didn't look for work in the last month, you are not counted as part of the labor force. But if you looked for work in the last year but not in the last month, you're counted as part of the discouraged worker group. Okay. And then there's also a question of, if you're working, are you working less than full-time, even though you'd want to be working full-time? And that those people are also calculated. The unemployment number then doesn't have anything to do with whether you're on extended benefits or you've exhausted your benefits or anything like that. The concern is that the combination of the number of unemployed and the number of people who are discouraged and the number of people who are working less than full-time, even though they'd want a full-time position, is still very large. Nationally, it's almost 17%, so about 1 in 6 of the people that would be considered to be in the workforce are either unemployed, discouraged, or working less than full-time for economic reasons. And that's the number that we need to focus on getting down.
Could I ask a follow-up question? We
done. Yeah, thank you.
That very first question, you said, are you working? And if you answer yes, you say you're employed. And how does that interact? You just referenced the underemployed. So if someone is working part-time, half-time, and they answer the question, are you working? Yes, but obviously
if you're
not bringing home a full paycheck.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, you are counted as employed if you're working 10 hours, even though you would prefer to have a job that was working 40 hours. But then you're also counted as part of this special group, which is individuals working less than full-time for economic reasons. And so the count that you have ends up having that in it anyway. You can get that in it.
Okay, that answers it. Then it's if you answer it yes, there must be a follow up. Are you working
yes.
more than 10 hours, and then you're counted as being employed at 10 hours?
No, Mr. Chairman, no. Representative Carlson, I think the follow up is, are you working full time? And then I think the follow up after that is, if you're working part time, would you rather have a full-time job, or are you working part-time because you can't find a full-time job?
Okay.
Do you want to, Representative Clark?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. So just to, I'm sorry, I want to make sure we got this. So if you want to work more but you can't get the hours, you are part of the unemployment number.
Okay. There are multiple unemployment numbers. There's a number called the U3, which is the number that you see in the headlines. And the number that you see in the headlines is counts you if you're working part-time, even though you'd want to work full-time. As you count you as being employed.
I was employed.
Okay. There's a second number called the U6 number that counts the number of people who are working less than full-time for economic reasons and discouraged workers and the unemployed together, and that number is much larger. Like I said, that's about 17%, and the national unemployment rate, I think, is 9.6% or something like that at this point.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hilty?
I think Representative Clark.
I'm sorry, Clark, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I just think it's important that that number, when we talk about unemployment, it has different meanings, and we just see the headlines, and it doesn't tell the whole story.
That's right.
And it's a real important discussion to have people who are, we're just talking, you know, want to work, but they can't find enough work. Or I think it would be interesting also to know that how many people are working two or three jobs. I know I have a lot of constituents who are working two or three jobs are still earning a low income, and I don't know if we count them anywhere. What would you call them? Poor, I guess. I mean, they're. I don't know how if we keep track of that in any way. Is there any way we do keep track of people who are working multiple jobs and their income is still quite low?
Dr. Stenson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, yes. The number of people holding multiple jobs is tracked at the state level and at the national level. And Minnesota has always been a state where we had a larger than national average number of people who were holding multiple jobs.
Okay, Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Stinson, still on this point, since this data is gathered by a survey, how extensive is the survey and what is the margin of error?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, the survey, I'm trying to remember.
It's another section of the MMB that does the survey, or from Dolly.
No,
that does
the U.S.
U.S.?
It's the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Okay. And I think the number is something like 50,000 or something like that. So it's not a big survey. The margin of error for the national numbers is astoundingly large. For the state numbers, it's even larger, and for states like New York and California with large populations, those are supportable just by the information that you gather within that state. For states like Minnesota, there's kind of a black box technique which takes the responses from Minnesota, but then they're tied to the responses from the Dakotas and Iowa and Nebraska and Missouri and massaged a little bit to get a little bit more statistical significance, but still they're not very strong. And when you go from state level data to county level data or even sub-regional data, north central or west central Minnesota or northwest Minnesota or something like that, those numbers are very weak in there. They give you the general direction, but a difference between 6.5% and 7% or something like that's certainly not statistically significant in those numbers.
Thank you.
Representative Westrom, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, some of it's been answered in how we calculate that number. Did you say, or did I wasn't sure if I heard, what is Minnesota's underemployed, unemployed, and discouraged workers number? Did you say that's about 9% versus the 7.3, or what is Minnesota's number compared to the national 17%?
Mr. Chairman, there isn't an official underemployment number in Minnesota. those numbers aren't collected nationally. One of my staff has done some work trying to come up with what the underemployed number is in the state. And I'm just looking here. It's in the main book here, the longer book, not the material that you have. He estimates that there are 22,000 more Minnesotans who've grown frustrated with the job market discouraged workers and given out, and 90,000 underemployed workers in the state. So in January there was a seasonally adjusted 216,000 estimated individuals who were unemployed, plus an additional 22,000 who are discouraged workers, plus an additional 90,000 who are underemployed, who are working less than full time for, even though they would rather have a full time job. And so the number would be about 50% higher, the combination of unemployed and underemployed would be about 50% higher.
Thank you.
Okay, want to continue on, Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, that pretty well concludes the economic outlook. Let me turn it over to Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Showalter?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Welcome. Chair. Continuing on to the slide that is titled Health and Human Services Account for Most of the Savings in the Forecast Spending. We'll just talk briefly about the expenditure side of this forecast. Unlike most years and most forecasts where the revenue swings are the dominant element of the forecast change, in this particular instance, the spending change is actually larger than the revenue swings. Altogether, $184 million down, about 0.6% from the November forecast. Couple of elements there are listed. K-12 education spending is down about $14 million, about 0.1%. That's due to a number of factors, dominated by slightly lower growth in enrollment, compensated by significantly higher poverty concentration counts that lead to compensatory ed entitlements. In the property tax aids and credits area, you see a savings of about $15 million. That's about 0.5% for that category. Much of that is associated with the property tax refunds being about $22 million lower than previously forecast. The dominant element of the forecast change is in health and human services. That's about a 1.6% decrease from the previous forecast. However, $82.9 million of that was already discussed about a week ago. That occurred when the Secretary of HHS announced that she would extend enhanced matching rates to a broader base of programs so that the federal government would essentially pick up a larger share of these expenditures. The estimate that's carried in this forecast is a savings of $82.9 million for the state. Essentially, we will be paying less for some of the Medicare clawback payments during this period of time. This is a one-time phenomena. It does not carry out into 12 and 13. There were some other more programmatic changes in this forecast in health and human services, though relatively small. Lower payments in the elderly and disabled category due to slightly lower enrollment numbers, slightly lower payment numbers, as well as in the chemical dependency treatment program. It was about a $15 million savings. Those lower spending numbers do not carry out into fiscal 12 and 13. If you take a look at the next slide, you'll see that the picture that we are projecting out into the next biennium has worsened somewhat. Spending is about where it had been in the November forecast, up $51 million. However, the revenue side has dropped slightly by $312 million, leading us to about a $5.8 billion challenge in the next biennium, up from the $5.4 billion deficit that was projected in the November forecast. As with November, There are a number of significant assumptions included in this forecast. They are noted here. They include some of the treatment of recent actions over the summer, as well as the standing note of estimated inflation, which is about $1.18 billion. Overall, that budget gap is about 15% of spending. To give you one more perspective on that future challenge, there's one last chart for you, and that really takes a look at how that spending number changes over time. We've talked at times about growth in spending, federal participation for Medicaid, and how these all interact. And we're trying to give you a very summarized version of some of the numbers that you'll see in the more detailed forecast document. $33.9 billion was the general fund spending in 2008-09, growing to about $38.7 billion in 12 and 13. Those are the numbers you'll see in our fund balance documents. However, due to the federal stimulus, the federal government is picking up a disproportionate or more than usual in the Medicaid costs, known as medical assistance in our state programs. We save about $500 million in the first biennium and about $2.1 billion in the next biennium. The spending is still occurring, but it's not occurring on the books of the general fund. So that next line just shows you the combined effect of what the underlying programs that we are running during that period of time and how that adjusted path would look, growing from about $34 billion to about $38.7 billion. If you wanted to take one more factor into account, and that is the effect of education payment shifts and property tax recognition shifts, you would see in 10 and 11 that decreases the overall spending level by about $1.7 billion, raises it by 1.2 in 12 and 13. And so there's another sort of adjusted spending line showing you some of the programmatic changes that are going on biennium to biennium, and also itemizing some of the major one-time sources that are present in 10 and 11, but are not there in 12 and 13. Just one other comment, and that is this recession has obviously had a significant impact on many elements of spending. One item that doesn't show up in this forecast is just how the pension funds are also impacted, and we've certainly talked with them recently. And if you look at some of the numbers for those pension funds, they're substantially lower in terms of the actuarial value and the market value than have been in the past. While positions and plans are being made to try to rectify that, you know, the impact of some of the market changes is pretty broad spread.
Okay, just some questions, but before we go into the questions, I have one. In your budget that you submitted to us, you were counting $5 million from the lottery. But your forecast says it's only $1.5 million or something like that. So we have a disconnect. I mean, I was kind of surprised that it was counted as spending availability in your budget to begin with. And I think everyone was a little shocked at that. But we expected to be picked up in the forecast. But we have a disconnect now. How are we going to resolve that?
Mr. Chair, excellent question. The $1 million that you see in that forecast document, I think the detailed fund balance is probably where you're pulling that number, is only a portion of the lottery numbers. So that is, I think, a lower than that's not the comprehensive view of the changes in the lottery over this forecast. I don't have I'm not sure what the exact number comparability of $5 million. That was the exact number, but I can certainly follow up with you on that. But the one item that is there is a little bit misleading. It's only part of that overall change.
Okay. Well, you need to work with the fiscal staff on that so we get a better understanding of that. You would. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure whether to ask this question, but it always bothers me when we talk about how cuts in Health and Human Services can then be counted as savings, because, you know, just taking the chemical dependency fund, so we don't treat people, in the end we are paying a lot more money, you know, in corrections and in a lot of other ways, and it's just hard to you think of the people on GAMC and the testimony we've been hearing in recent days. They're not really savings by cutting people off of those programs. It's going to cost a lot more in some other places in the budget, and I just, when you say that so easily, it's just hard to hear. And I just think it's important that we point out that what are being called savings on this chart are really not savings in terms of either human beings or just in terms of the dollars. They're really not.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, a fair point, and I don't mean to imply the ease or dis-ease of the situations of the people going through these programs. In terms of the chemical dependency treatment changes that you see here, they're not related to programmatic changes. They are actually related to some changes in assumptions, and actually the dollars that are being spent at the county level haven't been as much as had been previously expected. If you go back a couple of forecasts, you would see changes in the forecast that were going the other way, that is, significant increases in the estimated take-up of chemical dependency treatment programs. That assumption has not proven true. So it's not really an underlying change in the programs. It's actually the number of people who are being served by the counties given the current parameters of that program.
Representative Clark.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we don't have insurance that covers chemical dependency treatment, people aren't going to get treated, and that's what one of the reasons the numbers go down. Talk to any family who's trying to get their kid or their adult family member into treatment. They can't get them in because they're not covered by the insurance company. So, I mean, there's reasons why some of those numbers might be going down, and again, they're certainly not savings to the community.
Mr. Schalder, you mentioned, did you want to respond to the pension funds not being included, and what kind of a number would we be talking about if they were included? I know there's a shortfall or a need for funds.
Mr. Chair, there's three major pension funds. Just give you one example, MSRS, State Employee Retirement System. That typically has been one of the better funded of the three plans. Currently, the actuarial value of that is at 85.9%, which is actually astoundingly good. However, that is taking a smoothed, I believe it's 5-year average of its market values. If you actually took the market value of its portfolio right now, it would be down to about 65.6%. So for the next several years, you can anticipate that actuarial value to continue dropping as those losses are recognized and put into that rolling average. So that plan, as with TRA and PERA, which have lower funding levels than that even, are needing to make some adjustments, and those boards have been trying to put together plans both on the benefit side, actuarial assumption side, to try and pull those numbers and actually just to solidify those numbers.
Yeah, and the reason I was asking the question, in fact, I've met with them, and I'm aware that they've got planned, but you referenced that I was just interested in a clarification of what you meant when you said the numbers for that was not for the pension plans were not included. So that sounded like the need for an influx in addition to what they're doing of some state dollars at some level. That's what the question was.
And Mr. Chair, I did not mean to suggest that they are part of the general fund or even a new liability of the state. Just simply, it's another part of the financial infrastructure that might be relevant to the committee.
Okay. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to any one of our three testifiers. And page 6 on the 12 and 13 forecast, it appears that only the K-12 education shift is listed on the 12 and 13 forecast, but not the property tax recognition shift. I'm just wondering if there's a reason why for that. Or maybe it's a different explanation for why it's 1.2 versus the 1.727.
Would that be Mr. Showalter?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, you're looking at the chart on page 6.
Please look for 12 and 13.
Yeah, I think you said page 7. The chart on page 12 and showing
the handout.
Oh, the handout. Thank you. The change in 12 and 13 is related to the assumed end of the unallotment authority. That aid payment shift is done through the unallotment authority. That is only in effect through the current biennium. Since those underlying entitlements need to be paid up, essentially, in fiscal 12, we're assuming that will occur in fiscal 12 along with the regular payments at a 90-10 basis. So what happens is that aid payment shift really is only good for one biennium and then gets paid back in the next one. The property tax recognition shift is relayed on other authorities, and that really is ongoing. It's not a unallotment temporary situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Showalter, you said that there's a significant increase in education compensatory student costs. What are you basing that forecast on? Are there lots more poor families in Minnesota? Are they moving in? Are people losing their jobs? Or what were the assumptions for that forecast?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greiling, that is based on the data that MDE has put together. I believe it's on the free and reduced lunch, but Mr. Melcher is here if I misspeak. But basically, what we're seeing is about a 9.6 increase in the poverty concentration rate from earlier estimates. That underlies the compensatory ed formula.
Representative Grayling.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Showalter, so you're just projecting out and taking the trend line further and increasing, or how do you have the numbers for the next year? I mean, how come it's increasing from the numbers of students we have right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grayling, I see Mr. Melcher coming down, so I'm pleased by that.
Phone a friend.
Mr. Melcher, welcome.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. The February forecast update reflects the actual counts that we have now from October of 2009, the free and reduced lunch counts, which are up substantially, and that creates an impact immediately in the budget. We use prior year data, so the October 2009 counts will affect our fiscal 2011 compensatory budget, and then we did make some projections looking at kind of a trend line in terms of what's happened, and so there are some little softer numbers for 12 and 13 out there, but we think it's based on some pretty solid evidence that we have higher poverty concentrations that aren't appearing to be going down.
Representative Grayling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then I'm glad Dr. Melcher is up here, so I can ask about the QComp assumptions that are in the budget here and the fact that they're going up, and I've been told that that's because we're making assumptions about how many districts will apply because of Race to the Top, or in case we get it, then we'll have even more applying. And I'm just, you know, I've been wondering if there wouldn't be less districts in QComp with the application that we have, which districts after a short while have to have enhanced QComp, and then even some of the districts that have it right now, it seems to me, could not be able to negotiate that new higher bar for QComp. And so are you, when you base this assumption of, you know, all the various sections, are you assuming that we keep all the districts that we have in QComp and then continue to add even in the face of enhanced QComp?
Mr. Melcher.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Greiling, the forecast for QComp does assume that the current districts stay in and that other districts are added. In the November forecast, we assumed a continuation of the trend line over a three-year period, which is about a 3% increase in the percentage of students in the state that are participating in QComp. For the February forecast, we're showing a higher rate of increase based on additional information that we have received since November, which suggests that there is a great deal of renewed interest in the program. For example, the Department of Education is hosting a full-day program on Monday. We have over 200 participants and a sizable waiting list for participation in that program. So we know there's a lot of could be upside risk and downside risk in the QComp forecast, and when we get to November, we'll see kind of where we're at. But from everything we've seen, there is a very solid interest from the Anoka School District. We had a two-hour meeting with them in February, and they indicated a solid interest. They're a big district, so when they get added in, it increases our percentages quite a bit. We did show a reduction in the forecast for fiscal 10 because we have Minneapolis signed up as an approved program. They chose not to participate in 2010, but indicated that they plan to participate in 2011, so we showed a one-year dip and then them coming in 2011. And then we made a projection as to a percentage of the remaining districts based on the interest that we've seen. We're only expecting a fraction of the districts that have indicated a strong interest in coming in 11 would actually come in 11. But it appears that all of the information about RTTT, as well as what's happening at the federal level in terms of educational policy, I think, as well as what's happening at the state level in terms of sources of new revenue for school districts. I think right now access to $260 per student through the QCOM program is looking pretty good when the other major choice is going to the voters for a referendum election for additional dollars. So that's what this is based on. Again, it's a when you get out to 12 and 13, a lot could change before we get there, but that's the best we can do for now.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will be my final comment. It's just a comment, so Dr. Melcher doesn't have to comment on my comment unless he wants to. But, I just would say this to the members. We had a legislative auditor study last year that was inconclusive, that QCOMP, which we're now spending a lot of money on with great encouragement from Race to the Top as well as from our state, there's not any conclusive evidence at all that it's doing students any good. But we did have a really fine study this year on extended time revenue, which was frozen and decoupled from the formula in 2003. And that's part of the Race to the Top application for Minnesota as well. And yet there's no funding in here for that. So I'm always glad to see forecast education spending included. It's much better than flat funding that we've been having. But I hope that at some point we can consider the extended time revenue substituting for some of this QCOMP money, because that, the auditor found, makes a startling difference. We all kind of thought if you have more time in a school year and a school day and the students would do well, but they were shocked and startled at how much better they did, the students who are behind, for having this extra time. And yet there's no funding in here for that, and that's shown to work. So it's just a disconnect that I point out that we're well aware of in the Education Finance Committee and hope we can address at some point.
Mr. Chairman, at that point?
Well, I was going to recognize Representative Holbert next. I know that to that point is a way of getting ahead of everybody else, but let's stay in order. Are you going to yield? Okay, she yields, so then Representative Garofalo.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to my friend, the chairman of the K-12 committee, I would encourage members and also the members of the committee to read the legislative auditor's report. To categorize the entire report as inconclusive, I think, would be an incomplete understanding of the report. Even those participating in the study, those teachers, acknowledge the benefits of professional development and teachers training with regards to academic achievement and student learning. It is a new program, and the verdict is still out, but I think it would be an incomplete understanding to label it as being in the term that you categorize.
Mr. Chairman, I think that this is probably time for us to intercede because we don't want to be in the Education Committee.
Okay. Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schuwauer, just to back up a little bit about the Chemical Dependency Fund, is that the Rule 25 money that, in fact, doesn't have much to do with whether or not people have insurance or not, but rather state-paid chemical dependency treatment, based on whether or not people need the treatment?
Mr. Showalter, Representative Holbrook, this is not a part of the insurance programs. This is going through the counties.
And in fact, these programs, for the most part, the treatment is paid 100% by the taxpayers. Is that not correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's my understanding.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well, Mr. Chair, we haven't had a chance to have some quizzes with Commissioner Hansen, but there is one thing that I think both Representative Carlson and I want to bring up, and that is over the years of both, whether Democrats or Republicans are in charge of the committee, we've had kind of an understanding that changes to the budget, once they're submitted, are done in writing and signed by the commissioner. We received your budget, the governor's budget, and then we found that, I guess I'll be kind to you, that there were some misunderstandings from the number that was submitted, and I'll give you one misunderstanding was when the proposal to cut the $267,000 out of the snowmobile count was all of a sudden drawn back from it. Now, I know there's been several of those type of misunderstandings that in your submission that you've communicated with our fiscal staff. And usually what we do is we say that only will happen if it's in writing and signed by you. Because we're on a little bit of a time crunch, I think the fiscal staff has communicated with you and your staff that they built those changes into the numbers that we're working with. However, I think we do need to have all those changes verified in writing, and then going forward, an understanding of changes in the future would come underneath your signature. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Hansen.
Yes, it is. The we are, I think, sometime early next week, have all of the changes under my signature coming to you. You know, everything that has happened since our original submission, including the governor's announcement yesterday that we're putting the $209 million into the cash flow account. And you'll have all of that packaged. And I did get your and the chairman's letter, and I appreciate the latitude that you gave us. We submitted our supplemental budget to you a month earlier than we normally do, so we had a few tweaks that we took care of. So thank you.
They were tweaks instead of misunderstandings?
That's what I call them.
Right. Maybe I appreciate your response on that, or we both do. Maybe I could ask, being that you referenced the budget, we had in another committee, the Planning Fiscal Policy Subcommittee, a little discussion about the $387 million that you're expecting from the feds. And I did ask a question as to who in Washington you were talking to get that information, and you said you had staff there that was providing you with information. And my question today, is there anything new on the 387 that you can bring us up to date on?
Mr. Chairman, my source of information have been multiple. I mean, one, we have a governor's office out there, the staff person, like every governor has had. A second piece of information, and actually Mr. Showalter slipped it to me, we get from the Federal Funds Information Service that I think your staff gets as well. That's another source of information. Our budget officers have a association, and then the governor attended the annual winter meeting of NGA here a weekend or so ago, or last weekend. The general,
you were prepared for this question.
Well, I did. Well, I knew you would ask, but actually, the just heard from heard today that the FMAP found a vehicle in the Senate, and it has some tax changes that have broad bipartisan support, and I am a little more hopeful. But back to the genesis of your question, one of the reasons we placed the $209 million. In the cash flow account is to mitigate any other risks that might come forward going forward. So I hear what you're saying.
And yeah, the reason I asked that question is, you know, we will, now that we've got the February forecast before us, we begin moving in terms of putting the budget together from the House perspective, and one of the decisions we have to make then is how solid that 387 is. And you sound more optimistic today than perhaps you even did
before
planning and fiscal policy.
Right. The big issue was out there has always been the vehicle for it, and I think there's the information we got today and the information the governor brought and mentioned to me from this weekend is there's bipartisan support in the Senate now, and that there's they found a vehicle that they can possibly.
Any feel for the timeline on that vehicle, or
not? The reason and importance of the vehicle is I think to get it out sooner rather than the usual budget budgets that come out in August and September.
People that you seem to be getting information from, then if you could keep us informed on that, because that will become a crucial question as we move forward.
Definitely. We will. Jim and I will forward the email we got today from it's NASBO.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, when we received some federal funds in the stimulus package, you had estimated what they were going to be, and you've testified that we've received more than what that estimation is. How firm is your 387 number? Do you expect that to be the firm number? Have you verified that with everyone, or do you expect it to be less or more, or the chances of it being more?
Mr. Hanson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and Jim can follow up if I misstate anything. It's really they've talked about the first two quarters of 2011. So that's a figure that we can estimate, and then I think DHS estimated based on our some of the decisions we've made with the maintenance of effort that they came up with the number 387. Is that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, sure. Just to add on to the Commissioner's comments, the 387 really isn't even a net figure. The total amount that we would anticipate from these two quarters would be slightly higher, but we've already got in current law some provisions that would be disqualifying us from these additional two quarters. So that's where the Department of Human Services estimated that 387 net figure. That being said, I think this is a reasonable estimate. You know, there might be slight tweaks in the federal legislation as it goes through, but just assuming the same matching rate, assuming an additional two quarters, it's a pretty firm.
Well, Mr. Showalter, would you also, is it safe to then assume if you have a good basis for your 387 that the clawback would be provisions would be carried forward as well? And I think that's an additional $27 million in that area someplace. Have you calculated that, and have you had word that is something that we should be looking at?
Mr. Chair, we haven't calculated that, and we also haven't received any word as to whether the clawback would continue to be part of that enhanced FMAP or not. As you know, that was an administrative action that was just done last week, and I'm sure that'll get discussed more in the coming weeks. Right now, we are not anticipating and not including that in any of the figures that we've got.
Well, it would seem reasonable if you've established a program now that for 18 months that if you're going to continue that program, it would be continued on some kind of the same basis. But I have no other information than just some assumptions. Maybe a little bit of research would be helpful.
Very good.
Hey, are there any other questions? Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just a question of you. At our last joint committee, I did ask Senator Pogamiller about targets and when we're going to start getting those in the legislature. And we have the information now. It's not too different from the information we had previously. And I know that you and your staff have been working hard on putting all of this together. Mr. Chairman, we're hearing in some of the finance committees already bills which are actually expending more money. All right. And so I'm wondering, have targets been discussed amongst the finance, lead finance chairs in the House, and where are we at with that so that our side of the aisle can, you know, prepare and participate, you know, in those discussions?
Yeah, we've, as I mentioned to you before, Representative Biskins at a previous meeting, We have been working with the division chairs, and they've been working with the fiscal analysts to review their budgets to see where they could find savings. And I think it's fair to say that the targets will probably come out fairly soon. Okay. Now that we've got the, you know, it was just Tuesday that we got the new forecast. So we were waiting for the new forecast, and we'll be finalizing some things in the next few days.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I do appreciate that. I would, if I could, my recollection was fairly soon was exactly the same word Senator Pogamiller used over 2 weeks ago. So fairly soon, a week, are we looking at by mid-March?
I think it's fair to say probably earlier than that. But
thank you for your
I'm not the only one, and if Representative Solberg wants to well, chime in, there's several people working on these, including the division chairs. We're quite honestly, we're down to trying to solicit some additional information from a couple of division chairs that have been working with their analysts, and once we get that input, I think it'll break pretty fast.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, one of the other things, we're trying our best to do it smart. If that's an oxymoron in the legislature, so be it. But we are our best trying to understand, you know, the nuances of everything, and to try to make sure that we're making intelligent decisions in the process. So, and that's why I asked about the clawback, because if that is. That's a very important thing that I would hope that you would consider going forward. I don't know if anybody has thought about that in the department, but I think you need to have some kind of analysis of your sources. These are not our sources, but of your sources of that possibility. So,
and one of the reasons, Representative Biskins, that I was asking about the 387 is that that plays into this in a very big way, because that's literally about one-third of the problem that we have before us. So if there are no other questions, are you ready to adjourn?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay,
very much.
With that, thank you, and we are adjourned. Say